It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and here are the sounds of the week's top stories.
Yesterday, Group Health's board unanimously committed to joining Kaiser Permanente by signing an agreement to be acquired.
We applaud the appointment of two women to the board this year. They joined John and Satya to make Microsoft's board one of the most diverse in the industry.
If they're investing, as they have, in major ways in improving the health of the international community, it's an oxymoron then to invest in coal companies and oil companies that are creating the pollution that's impacting the health of people negatively.
We are exhilarated that finally these thousands of workers are going to get paid the wages that the voters of the city of SeaTac decided that they should get paid.
Jesse Jackson was in the Northwest this week holding the tech industry's feet to the fire over diversity. The state Supreme Court shut the door on further challenges to SeaTac's minimum wage law, and activists and Seattle College students resolved to find solutions on homelessness. And it's all against the backdrop of the horror in San Bernardino, California. But there are news stories that are important and fascinating and yet didn't make it into the week's headlines. So here now with some analysis of the week's underreported stories are Ansel Hertz, reporter for The Stranger, Alex Hudson, writer for the news and politics blog Seattle-ish, and Rosette Royale, independent journalist here in Seattle. Hey guys, welcome back to Sound Effect.
Hi.
Hey.
Howdy.
So we're going to start with our undercovered stories. Why don't we get underway with you, Ansel? What is your underreported story this week?
My underreported story is contract negotiations between the City of Seattle and the Seattle Police Officers Guild, which is the union that represents rank-and-file cops in Seattle, about 1,200 officers. These negotiations have been going on for over a year now, and they are held in secret. And they're what the co-chair of the Community Police Commission calls the Super Bowl of police accountability in Seattle, because so much hinges on the outcomes of those negotiations. SPOG's contract with the city impedes accountability for cops in certain ways. It limits civilian oversight. It creates deadlines for investigations into misconduct. And if those deadlines are missed, no discipline can be imposed on cops. There are a whole bunch of very technical things in that contract that need to be changed if we're actually going to have police reform in the city.
Yeah, and so police reform has obviously been an issue that's been dealt with in the public sphere pretty explicitly in terms of the city's proposals, the Department of Justice oversight, the Community Police Commission, and so on. How important is what's going on right now but behind closed doors to that larger, longer-term process?
Well, so the Community Police Commission, which are a group of civilians who are trying to exert some oversight over the police department, there's a group that was set up in the wake of the Department of Justice reforms. They made 55 recommendations to how to improve police accountability in Seattle. A bunch of those have to be approved now by the federal court, but a bunch of them have to be negotiated with the police union because the current contract prevents the city from changing the law. And so it's just kind of in those two different ballparks, and nobody really is talking that much about what is happening in the negotiating room. SPOG endorsed the mayor, Mayor Ed Murray. So there are questions to be asked about how hard the city is pushing in the negotiations. And we saw this actually in Chicago over the past couple of weeks. This video of this horrific shooting of a 17-year-old came out, and people kind of turned their attention to, well, what are the ways in which the contract between the Chicago Police Union and the city there inhibited oversight of that process? And there are things like the officers who are involved in shootings get multiple days of advance notice before they can be interviewed about what happened, which is kind of silly. It allows the officers to figure out what their recollection is of what happened, but what critics say is that it actually allows the officers to sort of get their story straight before they're asked what actually happened.
Ansel, you said there are 55
recommendations, yeah, that the CPC made of all kinds of different ways, some of them highly technical but pretty important, in which the accountability system in Seattle could really be improved. One of those, for example, is there's this Office of Professional Accountability, which investigates misconduct. Right now, it's only staffed with police officers. So when a civilian has a complaint about something that a police officer did with them, they go into that office and they're then interviewed by a police officer. And some people find that very intimidating. They'd rather talk to another civilian and have a more independent perspective. And that's something that has to be negotiated with the police union.
Are those officers in uniform?
Yeah, often they are, sometimes.
Wow.
How much do we know about the substance of the negotiations?
virtually nothing. There was a reporter from Capitol Hill Seattle blog earlier this week who tweeted out, like, hey, what's the status of these negotiations? And Spog responded to him, nothing to report. And so
that's always a good sign.
There's your headline.
Yeah. So, you know, nothing going on here, nothing to see here. And then also, interestingly, this week, checkthepolice.org, which is a new site set up by some Black Lives Matter activists on the national level, did an analysis of lots of different police union contracts around the country. Mm-hmm. And they mentioned Seattle in their infographic as having some issues in the contract that need to be changed. And Spog responded on their Facebook page with a comment that said, yes, folks, we are under attack. And they linked to this checkthepolice.org.
Oh, like Exhibit
website.
A.
Yeah, like thing. Exhibit A, we are under attack by Black Lives Matter activists, simply because they're raising some policy-based criticisms of what is in our police union contract, which just seems kind of crazy. And a lot of people are saying that seems to embody the us versus them mentality that right. some officers have, unfortunately.
Yeah. And so do we have a deadline to be keeping an eye on for this, Ansel?
Again, like, no, open not really. It's just, you know, the city will not really tell me anything at all because of federal labor law that shrouds these negotiations in official secrecy about what the status is, how much progress has been made, if any.
What's the official reason why the secrecy is needed? Is labor law protections?
Yeah, it's federal labor law. And actually, the last time I talked to the mayor about this, I was trying to sort of ask him, you know, what are you going to be pushing for in the negotiating room? And he said, he kind of got angry and he said, look, I'm a Democratic mayor. I'm a Democrat. I believe in the collective bargaining process. So I'm not going to talk to you about any of that. Like, that would be inappropriate. And the CPC has called for the Community Police Commission. The civilian oversight folks have called for advisors on accountability to be in the negotiating room. Mm-hmm. But that was something that the mayor also rejected. He said that would violate the process is the claim that he made.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that, Ansel. Alex Hudson, how about you? What's your underreported story this week?
So I think it's been widely reported what's been going on with the First Hill streetcar. It was slated to have begun service well over a year and a half ago, and we still don't have any of that service. It's the new streetcar that'll run from King Street Station connecting to the Capitol Hill Light Rail Station. What has been officially said is the reason for this, and again, it's hard to kind of get a direct answer, is that there's problems with the battery systems. These are the first streetcars of their kind. They can go on and off the cantilever, so they can run in battery, and they'll be able to do that as they're going downhill. So the manufacturer Inicon is based out of the Czech Republic. Because these are the first cars of their kind, they're the only manufacturer that seems to be able to be the preferred vendor for the city to create these cars. So we bought 7 cars. One of them will be a replacement for cars in South Lake Union, and then the 6 others will be for the First Hill streetcar. Because of the extreme delays, Inicon has been receiving daily penalties, which are now figuring at about $1.3 million. This First Hill streetcar is due to begin very soon, and I actually believe it this time because you can see them with your eyes. But what's unclear, so the $1.3 million isn't going to be a check that's written to the city. It's a reduction on the final invoice for the cars, so it's a subtraction. So this has kind of been widely published in the media as being like a good thing, like, oh, you know, they've been punished and all this. But what's not being reported is the extreme cost to the city in terms of labor overruns. So they've had to have, you know, an extra year and a half worth of staff time dedicated to this project. And, you know, they're highly qualified staff, like the engineers and all of that. So it's a significant cost. What's unclear is whether or not SDOT is going to continue to have Inicon as a preferred vendor for these cars, especially as we're having the City Connector going through its fundraising process right now. That'll be a streetcar that would connect the South Lake Union streetcar to the First Hill streetcar. And so it's hard to get answers about what exactly is going on with the money and what exactly is going on with the cars. And so hopefully when the pressure valve is off and the cars are actually running, we'll be able to find out a little bit more about what the next steps are.
Has anybody tried to tally up the cost of all that staff time, for example, and the travel involved and whatever other costs the city incurs over a course of a year's delay?
You know, not that I've seen, like, the travel, Scott Kubley, the director of the Seattle Department of Transportation, went to the Czech Republic after, like, the second announcement of delay over there. And the city claims that that came at no cost to the city. But there's always opportunity costs. Like there are other things that we can and should be doing with the Department of Transportation.
So did he just like pay out of his own pocket for whatever he was eating in the Czech Republic?
The vendor. Like,
okay,
the vendor.
I see.
The vendor's paid.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, how did we end up with this particular vendor in the Czech Republic? It's because of the cantilever thing?
So they are the same kind of vendor who actually built the 787 batteries in Econ. So they specialize in these kind of advanced technology and batteries.
Hey, those worked out awesome.
Yeah. I would definitely feel comfortable getting on a 787.
And interesting, in an early conversation, you made the point that we have this gigantic transportation levy now coming down the pike. And so this could potentially be a sign of things to come, or is this unrelated, do you think, to this future project?
Our taxpayers just wrote a $1 billion check to the Seattle Department of Transportation.
Yes.
And that includes several of these large-scale projects, you know, 7 rapid bus ride lines, major overhauls of street systems. And so there was some argument when Move Seattle was being pushed through that there was no oversight of where that money was actually going. So there was a push to get that line item budget. And so I think it's incumbent upon us that as citizens, when we write these giant checks to the city, that we're clear about how that money is being spent most appropriately.
Well, I appreciate you bringing it to the table, Alex. Thank you for that. And let's wrap it up with you, Rosette Royale. What's your undercover story?
So, you know, we were just here a little while ago talking about our phones, right? And our iPhone's dying, and so not everyone can afford an iPhone Android, right? So a lot of people relied on payphones, but I think most of us know that payphones, they're just kind of dwindling. Mm-hmm. They're just kind of disappearing slowly but surely.
And this is kind of a joke among a lot of people, right? They're like, oh, payphones, they're so quaint.
But yeah, right. Oh, look at that nice little relic, right? It's sort of a funny thing. But really, to people who can't afford phones or people who have phones that break and can't afford to repair them, or who have minutes that max out and can't afford new minutes till the next month, a payphone is a lifeline. Mm-hmm. And so in 2014, last time there was a study done, there were about 3,100 payphones in Washington State. That was almost 2 years ago, right? So who knows how many more are left. Here in Seattle, there are 8 at the Central Public Library, but one is out of order, at least it was by last week. And, you know, there are 3 payphones at the Green Lake Community Center. Those are broken, out of order. So there are these payphones that are around, but many of them are out of order, right? And so then someone who has a broken phone, who can't afford a phone, has to go to find a phone that works. So think about if you know where a phone is and you think, oh, you know, I'm going to go to the Green Lake Community Center. I'm going to take a shower because you can take a shower there, right? Use the bathroom. Oh, I need to make a phone call. Oh, no phone. Then where are you going to go? And I was just in the library, the central branch, the other day, and was walking in the fiction stacks, and like, there are the payphones, and there were 3 people using payphones.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And that's important for people trying to get jobs or to connect with family or to get services that they need and everything else, right?
Right. So I've been the interim editor for a little while at Real Change. And so next week, we're actually going to have a story about payphones. And we had this young reporter. His name is Erasmus Baxter. Did a really great job with the story. He was at the Central Library branch. And there was a man there who was trying to get an advance on his SSI because he had to pay a bill that was due that day. But he didn't have a phone to call, so he had to go to the library to make this phone call. So I imagine, right, he's got to keep putting quarters in the machine to try to speak to someone. Social Security Administration, they're always putting you on hold, right? So he somehow got to keep feeding the machine to get an answer to help him get money to help him pay a bill.
So do you think that the answer is, like, let's build more payphones? Or is it just let's make sure that there's a phone available, a public phone for, you know, maybe just a normal landline at social service agencies or city buildings or something like that?
I think we just need to have more phones available. We don't need to have 8,000 more payphones in the city, right?
We don't.
But there is one good thing about payphones in libraries is that, you know, most of the libraries used to have payphones. Now it's just the central branch. But libraries keep lists of where payphones are. So you can at least go to the library and find out where the phones are. There's no guarantee the phone's going to be operational, but at least you can find a phone. So at least that's a benefit. So I think if there were more ways for people to know where to find the thing they needed, then that would at least help to deal with the problem of the dwindling.
You know what this reminds me of is that there's so many simple things that we can do that alleviate the time and the stress and the frantic nature of what it is to be in poverty. So I think about, like, when are we getting lockers in Seattle? Like, these simple, simple, simple things, access to payphones, somewhere to put your stuff, like a bathroom, a shower, that seem like, you know, basic and fundamental amenities for people that we just don't have, and then, you know, continue to vilify people who are poor for, you know, not being middle class or whatever.
I just wonder too if at the library, I think they have some public computers, but last I recall, they don't have like microphones set up, and so you wouldn't be able to use like Google's free calling service, which you can, you know, access through Gmail on those public computers because there's no microphone. At least last I remember.
Maybe
if they just added some mics to the computers and they sort of advertise that a little bit as another way to use the phones.
Right. Like, well, and the thing about then is you would be able to have a number, because if you get a Google Voice number, like you have your own number. So it's not only something you can call out, but people can call in.
Do you know, Rosette, does community voicemail still exist? I know that as an organization, community voicemail, which once established third-party voicemail accounts for homeless and indigent people, they dissolved, but we're looking for somebody else to pick up that bit of their mission. And I just don't know what became of it.
I don't know, actually, but now I'm going to go look into it. Can I call you? Can I call you on my payphone in 5 minutes?
That's great. Well, listen, everybody, I really appreciate the stories that you brought today and throughout your roundtable careers here on Sound Effect. Thank you so much. Ansel Hertz of The Stranger, Rosette Royale of Rosette Royale, and Alex Hudson of Seattle-ish. Thank you guys for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gabe.
It's
thank
a
you. And power to you all.
Yeah.
KPLU strong.
KPLU forever.